Greetings. This is Tyler McFeeters with your News Gazette, dated Friday, November 21st, 2025. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with an article headlined, Mount Calvary Missionary Baptist Fire. Church leaders suspect arson. They also vow to rebuild. We're not going anywhere. Story by Jana Wiersema, out of Champaign. The pulpit and a couple of Bibles were the only items in Mount Calvary Missionary Baptist Church's sanctuary that remained largely unscathed after a devastating fire Wednesday, which church leaders believe was set deliberately. The Reverend John Porter, the church's head pastor, said a plan has yet to be determined for where the congregation will worship for the time being. We have had multiple calls from different pastors in the community, giving us the space to worship with them, he said. And I believe that's probably going to be our move going forward until we can get our sanctuary built back up. The fire damage was confined to the sanctuary, which was essentially charred from the front to the back, said Associate Pastor Leonard McInnes II. The only two items that remain standing are the pulpit and a couple of Bibles that somehow managed to escape the wrath of this heat, he said. Porter, who was out of town, said he heard about the fire from a member of the church who called him. When I first got the news, I was hurt, but I feel confident, he said, and I feel confident that God is going to restore everything that we lost. The Champaign Fire Department responded to the fire about 12:30 p.m. Wednesday, and firefighters from Urbana joined in after it was raised to a second alarm. No injuries were reported. Investigators were still working to identify the fire's cause on Thursday, Champaign Fire spokesman Randy Smith said. However, McInnes said there is evidence that someone broke into the church, and the idea that the two incidents are unrelated seems highly unlikely to him. Porter believes that someone threw a rock through our window, threw the glass in the front door, and went in the church and started the fire in the pulpit where I preach from. In a statement issued Thursday to the News Gazette, Champaign police said they are investigating. We can confirm that CPD investigators are working alongside the Champaign Fire Department and pursuing all leads to determine the cause of the structure fire, the statement said. Nearby residents are asked to check exterior-facing video cameras and report anything suspicious spotted between 11 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. on Wednesday. Anyone with information about the fire's cause is asked to call police at 217-351-4545. Those who wish to remain anonymous can contact Champaign County Crime Stoppers at 217-373-8477 or 373tips.com or via the free P3 Tips mobile app. Porter said he is praying that anyone who knows anything or saw anything will let the church know. He also asked that the community keep Mount Calvary in its prayers. Additionally, McKinney said Mount Calvary is working with its security firm, ADT, to see what footage can be gleaned from the church's cameras. Both church leaders said they don't know what motives a potential perpetrator might have had, although McKinney noted that there is a long history of black churches being burned. But what we know about the individuals in these spaces is that the resiliency, the faith of those within, somehow coalesce, he said, and the believers are able to recover and to push through. McKinney said he's grateful for the support offered not just by other churches, but also the larger community. When asked how long it might take to rebuild the sanctuary, Porter replied that it will likely depend on the cost of the project and where the help comes from. It's going to happen, he said. However much time it takes, we're going to be patiently waiting on that. It may take us a couple years. If not, then we're grateful for that. But however long it takes, we're not going anywhere. The next front page story is ISHA Football Class 3A Semifinal, Unity versus St. Joseph Ogden, Sharing a Table. Sydney Saloon brings Rockets Spartans fans together ahead of Saturday's showdown. Story by Rob Lacates. On Saturday, longtime rivals St. Joseph Ogden and Unity will go head-to-head with a trip to the IHSA State Football Finals on the line. On Thursday, fans of both high schools teamed up for a good cause at a neutral site. Sydney saloon owner Steve Littlefield threw a party that had Spartans and Rockets playing nice 2 days before one of the most important games in a spirited series. Littlefield can relate to both sides. His popular bar is on Main Street in a Unity town, and his daughters were cheerleaders at SJO during high school. They may have a rivalry, but the kids seem to all get along, Littlefield said. They're all good kids in both school districts, and so they may play tough out on the field or on the sidelines cheering, but when it's all said and done, they're still friends. And then there's a picture of Unity High School football parent Madonna Wyant left talks about son Matthew Brady playing in Saturday's IHSA Class 3A semifinal against St. Joseph Ogden on Thursday night at the Sydney Saloon in Sydney, which is hosting fans of and holding fundraisers for both teams. And then there's another picture of Sydney Saloon. Anyway, the story continues. 10% of proceeds from food sales on Thursday and a half of a 50-50 raffle were split and given to each district's booster club. Littlefield urged patrons to show up in school colors on a night geared toward the alumni, he said, hoping that we can have a little fun with it and it'll get a little more build-up before we go into the game on Saturday. Fans started to gather close by 7 p.m., including two Unity football parents, Madonna and Jeff Wyant, who will be watching for their son, Matthew Brady. Jeff said the game will certainly be one for the history books. Both teams came a long way this season, and it may be the best game for each time of the year, he said. The Rockets beat the Spartans earlier this season. Fan interest is skyrocketing ahead of Round 2, which kicks off 1 p.m. Saturday. The small-town, community-minded folks support and love their schools and school districts, Littlefield said. That's the reason a lot of folks live in small communities like that, is because of the school districts. And the final front page story is Champagne Stabbing Trial. Rantoul man convicted of murder in knife attack. Judge finds 24-year-old guilty of slashing woman's throat, killing her boyfriend. By Luke Taylor. Urbana. A Rantoul man has been found guilty of murder and attempted murder in a brutal knife attack on two Champaign residents earlier this year. The surviving victim, who said Alex Mwanambuda, 24, held her up by her hair as he reached around and cut her throat, testified Monday. She said that even after she played dead, the attack continued. The knife wound fractured her spine. If I believe her testimony, then, in a sense, game over, said Champaign County Judge Randy Rosenbaum, who was the sole fact finder in the bench trial, and I believed her. Prosecutors said the woman's boyfriend, Nathan Gudeman, 22, of Champaign, was found dead nearby, appeared to have died not from one of several stab wounds inflicted when Mwanamba attacked him in his own kitchen on March 22, but from a final slash to the neck when he was chased down outside. A neighbor testified to seeing Mr. Goodman running and being chased by a man who matched Mwanambuda's description. He said he looked like he was on a mission, the witness said. Rosenbaum found Mwanambuda guilty on 7 counts, including murder, attempted murder, and aggravated battery. Due to the severity of the attacks, he also ruled that the crimes included exceptional brutality and heinous behavior indicative of wanton cruelty. Mwanambuda testified Thursday as the defense presented its case, claiming that he had witnessed the crime but had not been the perpetrator. According to his testimony, the reason he left his phone behind and turned off the dash camera in his vehicle on the night of the attack, as police determined, was that he was trying not to be found by his girlfriend, who typically had his phone passwords. He said that he had recently been discovering feelings of attraction to other men, something that was deeply unacceptable in his family's culture, and was exploring by meeting men on the dating app Grindr. According to his testimony and data obtained by the defense, he had met with a man who lived very close to the scene of the crime, the residence of Mr. Gudeman and his girlfriend. After getting in an argument with his own girlfriend and resolving it, Mwanambuda said, he remembered he had a meet-up planned with that man. He left, telling his girlfriend he had forgotten his wallet at a mosque he had visited earlier that day and was going to retrieve it, he said. After approaching the man's hospital, Muinambuda said he got cold feet and decided to be loyal to his girlfriend, but having already left his phone at the mosque to disguise his location, he didn't have directions and got turned around while trying to get back. He claimed he remembered that his friends, the two victims, lived down the street and went to go ask them for directions. Once there, he found the door ajar with blood on it and stepped inside to find the female victim bleeding on the floor, then heard the male victim yelling somewhere, he testified. Muinambuda said he saw police on the way and left, not wanting to be caught there and have to reveal his infidelity. However, when he was detained later that night, investigators found what was determined to be Mr. Goodeman's blood on the top of his shoes. A footprint matching his shoes was also found near Mr. Goodeman's body. The female victim has named Muinambuda as her attacker since the moment the first police officer arrived on the scene. She and her family, as well as Mr. Goodeman's family, celebrated Rosenbaum's verdict in court Thursday evening at the end of the 4-day trial. Moving now to national and world news. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Evidence-based... Oh my gosh. Sorry, that headline is mistyped. Decision-based evidence-making. CDC website changed to contradict long-standing scientific conclusion that vaccines don't cause autism. Story by Mike Stobie, AP medical writer, out of New York. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website has been changed to contradict the longtime scientific conclusion that vaccines do not cause autism, spurring outrage among a number of public health and autism experts. The CDC Vaccine Safety webpage was updated Wednesday, saying the statement, "Vaccines do not cause autism," is not an evidence-based claim. The change is the latest move by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to revisit and foster uncertainty about long-held scientific consensus about the safety of vaccines and other pharmaceutical products. It was immediately decried by scientists and advocates who have long been focused on finding the causes of autism. "We are appalled to find that the content of the CDC webpage, Autism and Vaccines, has been changed and distorted, and is now filled with anti-vaccine rhetoric and outright lies about vaccines and autism," the Autism Science Foundation said in a statement Thursday. "Widespread scientific consensus and decades of studies have firmly concluded there is no link between vaccines and autism. The conclusion is clear and unambiguous," Dr. Susan Cressley, president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, said in a statement Thursday. "We call on the CDC to stop wasting government resources to amplify false claims that sow doubt in one of the best tools we have to keep children healthy and thriving, routine immunizations. The CDC has, until now, echoed the absence of a link in promoting Food and Drug Administration licensed vaccines. But anti-vaccine activists, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who this year became Secretary of Health and Human Services, have long claimed there is one. It's unclear if anyone at CDC was actually involved in the change, or whether it was done by Kennedy's agency, which oversees the CDC. Many at CDC were surprised. I spoke with several scientists at CDC yesterday, and none were aware of this change in content," said Dr. Deborah Horry, who was part of a group of CDC top officials who resigned from the agency in August. "When scientists are cut out of scientific reviews, then inaccurate and ideologic information results." The updated page does not cite any new research. It instead argues that past studies supporting a link have been ignored by health authorities. HHS has launched a comprehensive assessment of the causes of autism, including investigations on plausible biologic mechanisms and potential causal links. Additionally, we are updating the CDC's website to reflect gold standard evidence-based science, agency spokesman Andrew Nixon said in an email Thursday. A number of former CDC officials have said that what the agency posts about certain subjects, including vaccine safety, can no longer be trusted. Dr. Daniel Jernigan, who also resigned from the agency in August, told reporters Wednesday that Kennedy seems to be going from evidence-based decision-making to decision-based evidence-making. U.S. Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican of Louisiana, earlier this year played a decisive role in approving Kennedy's nomination for HHS Secretary. Cassidy initially voiced misgivings about Kennedy, but in February said Kennedy had pledged, among other things, not to remove language from the CDC website pointing out that vaccines do not cause autism. The news site continues to have a headline that says, "Vaccines do not cause autism," but HHS officials put an asterisk next to it. A note at the bottom of the page says the phrasing has not been removed due to an agreement with the chair of the U.S. Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee that it would remain on the CDC website. Cassidy's spokespeople did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The Associated Press Health and Science Department receives support from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute's Department of Science Education and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The AP is solely responsible for all content. Next on national and world news, hate symbols and incidents. Coast Guard set to change policy to call swastikas and nooses potentially divisive. Out of Washington and the AP. The U.S. Coast Guard is poised to change some of its language and policies surrounding the display of hate symbols like swastikas and nooses, as well as how personnel report hate incidents. The service stressed, however, that the symbols will remain prohibited. The updated policy is seen by the Coast Guard as a way to strengthen its ability to report, investigate, and prosecute violators. Any display, use, or promotion of such symbols, as always, will be thoroughly investigated and severely punished, Admiral Kevin Lunday, acting commandant of the Coast Guard, said in a statement. A Coast Guard message in 2020 from then-commandant Carl Schultz said symbols like swastikas and nooses were widely identified with oppression or hatred, and called their display a potential hate incident. The Coast Guard policy dated this month called those same symbols potentially divisive, adversely affecting morale, discipline, unit cohesion, and mission effectiveness. The new policy maintains a years-long prohibition on publicly displaying the Confederate flag outside of a handful of situations, such as educational or historical settings. However, it does not outright ban it, saying the policy does not apply to private spaces outside of public view, such as family housing. The new Coast Guard policy, which is set to take effect December 15th and was first reported by the Washington Post, is facing pushback. Senator Jackie Rosen, Democrat of Nevada, said this updated policy rolls back important protections against bigotry and could allow for horrifically hateful symbols like swastikas and nooses to be inexplicably permitted to be displayed. At a time when anti-Semitism is rising in the United States and around the world, relaxing policies aimed at fighting hate crimes not only sends the wrong message to the men and women of our Coast Guard, but it puts their safety at risk, she added. Lunday said the policy does not roll back any prohibitions, calling it categorically false to claim otherwise. These symbols have been and remain prohibited in the Coast Guard per policy, Lunday said in a statement, adding that any display, use, or promotion of such symbols, as always, will be thoroughly investigated and severely punished. Lunday's predecessor, Admiral Linda Fagan, was fired on President Donald Trump's first day in office. Trump officials later said she was fired in part for putting an excessive focus on diversity and inclusion efforts that diverted resources and attention from operational imperatives. Next on national and world news, Trump administration. Plans announced for oil drilling off coasts of California, Florida. Out of Washington in the AP. The Trump administration announced on Thursday new oil drilling off the California and Florida coasts for the first time in decades, advancing a project that critics say could harm coastal communities and ecosystems, as President Donald Trump seeks to expand U.S. oil production. The oil industry has been seeking access to new offshore areas, including Southern California and off the coast of Florida, as a way to boost U.S. energy security and jobs. The federal government has not allowed drilling in federal waters in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, which includes offshore Florida and part of offshore Alabama, since 1995, because of concerns about oil spills. California has some offshore oil rigs but there has been no new leasing in federal waters since the mid-1980s. Since taking office for a second time in January, Trump has systematically reversed former President Joe Biden's focus on slowing climate change to pursue what the Republican calls U.S. energy dominance in the global market. Trump, who recently called climate change the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world, created a National Energy Dominance Council and directed it to move quickly to drive up already record-high U.S. energy production, particularly fossil fuels such as oil, coal, and natural gas. Meanwhile, Trump's administration has blocked renewable energy sources such as offshore wind and canceled billions of dollars in grants that support hundreds of clean energy projects across the country. The drilling proposal drew bipartisan pushback in Florida, where a spokesperson for Republican Governor Ron DeSantis said the Trump administration should reconsider, and Republican Senator Rick Scott said the state's coasts must remain off the table for oil drilling. Democratic California Governor Gavin Newsom, a frequent Trump critic, called the administration's plan idiotic. Tourism and access to clean beaches are key parts of the economy in both states. The administration plan proposes 6 offshore lease sales between 2027 and 2030 in areas along the California coast. It also calls for new drilling off the Florida coast in the Gulf of Mexico, at least 100 miles from shore. Drilling leases would be sold in the newly designated South Central Gulf region, adjacent to the Central Gulf's thousands of wells and hundreds of drilling platforms. The new designation distinguishes the targeted area from the Eastern Gulf, where drilling is prohibited under a moratorium Trump signed in his first term. Industry representatives said the change was aimed at addressing concerns from Florida officials who oppose drilling near their tourism-friendly coasts. The 5-year plan would also compel more than 20 lease sales off the coast of Alaska, including a newly designated area known as the High Arctic, more than 200 miles offshore in the Arctic Ocean. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum said in announcing the sales that it would take years for the oil from new leases to get to market. And the next story is under the Illinois Commerce Commission. Regulators slashed proposed gas rate hikes by Ameren Nicor by over 40%. Story by Maggie Dougherty, Capital News, Illinois, out of Chicago. The Illinois Commerce Commission sharply cut rate increases proposed by Ameren Illinois and Nicor Gas, slowing the speed of rising energy bills for customers in much of the state. Instead of approving the full $314 million requested by Nicor and $129 million requested by Ameren, regulators cut 47% and 43% from their requests, respectively. As a result, the agency approved a rate increase of $168 million for Nicor and $73 million for Ameren. Agency Chair Doug Scott said the decision was made after careful review to approve only necessary and justified projects while striking excess spending. The ICC's responsibility is to balance the interests of Illinois' utilities and their customers, Scott said. We recognize that any decision impacting Illinoisans' bills is not a small one. Nicor, the largest gas utility in the state, serves 2.3 million customers in northern Illinois and the Chicago suburbs. In January, it originally requested a $309 million rate increase that was estimated by the company to raise typical residential bills by about $7.50 per month, or about 9%. At the time, the request was the largest in state history before it was amended up to the new $314 million amount. In a statement released after the decision, Nicor estimated that typical residential customers would see an increase of less than $4.25 monthly, or less than 5% annually. Ameren, which provides natural gas delivery to about 816,000 customers in central and southern Illinois, filed in January for a $134 million rate increase that a spokesperson said would increase typical residential bills by about $9.09 per month, an 11.9% increase. Ameren spokesperson Ellie Leonard said in an email to Capital News Illinois that Ameren was still reviewing the agency's order and running calculations to determine the rate impact to consumers. The company said the increases were needed to fund replacements or retirements of aging infrastructure for gas transmission lines and upgrades to gas storage facilities. As we enter the winter season, the safety and vitality of our 800,000 residential, public sector, and business customers depends on our ability to deliver natural gas on the coldest of days without interruption, said Brad Klopel, Ameren's Senior Director of Gas Operations and Technical Services. Ameren also touted its use of underground storage facilities, which allow the company to buy gas in the summer when prices are typically lower and deliver it to customers at a stable price during the winter heating season. But consumer advocates say all the upgrades are not necessary, or at least not now. Abe Scar, director of the Illinois Policy Interest Research Group, said NICOR has a system that operates safely and well overall. Investing in major infrastructure upgrades now, he said, does not necessarily make sense for consumers. It makes a big difference if you invest in a new pipeline in 2020 versus 2025, and it makes a big impact on consumers and consumer rates, Scar said. So it's not only a question of, is this investment reasonable or prudent at all? It's also, does it need to be made now? While consumer and environmental advocates applaud regulators' decision to minimize rate increases, some said any amount was still too high after repeated steep rate increases over the past decade. According to the research group, this is the fifth increase for NICOR since 2017 and the fourth for Ameren since 2018. With this increase, NICOR's sales will have risen by 137% since 2017 and Ameren's by 70% since 2018, Scar said. The Citizens Utility Board, a nonprofit Illinois utility watchdog group, contrasted the costs for consumers with the utility's growing profits over the same periods. It's beyond troubling that a corporation getting so fat on its own prosperity continues to demand ever greater financial sacrifices from its customers, group member Jim Chilson said of NICOR in a statement. He released a similar statement regarding Ameren. In recent years, however, regulators have proven more willing to diminish rate requests. In November 2023, the commission slashed requests by Ameren, NICOR, and two other Chicago-area gas utilities by 25 to 50%. The following month, it rejected a pair of grid plans from electric utilities Commonwealth Edison and Ameren, citing significant shortcomings and transparency concerns. While advocates had mixed responses to the rate case decisions, they found other items to celebrate in the agency's nearly 400-page rulings. The commission also rejected a proposal by Ameren to capture biomethane gas released as organic material such as livestock manure, food waste, and sewage breakdown. Ameren sought to capture that gas and refine it into pipeline-quality gas to be used as an alternative energy source, reducing the amount of unburned methane gas going into the atmosphere. However, the commission found that Ameren did not prove that the project would reduce carbon emissions in a cost-effective way. Capital News Illinois is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service that distributes state government coverage to hundreds of news outlets statewide. It is funded primarily by the Illinois Press Foundation and the Robert R. McCormick Foundation. And we will take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette, dated Friday, November 21st, 2025. Please stay tuned.